And welcome everyone to a special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is number 17. And joining us today for a talk about Jackie Brown and probably the assorted works of Quentin Tarantino is Facebook friend Paul Rye. How you doing, Paul?
I am doing wonderful. How are you today, Nick?
Doing great. And of course, we got Frank over here on the other line as well. What's going on, buddy?
Hello.
So we're super excited.
On that one? Okay. Yep. Go ahead. Yeah.
Super excited to talk finally about Quentin Tarantino. We've been talking about how we haven't been doing a lot of our old school shows because we've been so lucky to get some really, 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 really cool guests on the show, which of course Frank and I love to do, but we love to do our regular shows. And it dawned on us that we had not done anything on Quentin Tarantino, so we needed to remedy that quick. And we know that Paul is a big fan of Jackie Brown. So considering, Paul, that you are our guest, why don't you start it off with why when we were talking about Tarantino and, you know, talking about you coming on and talk about Jackie Brown, what is it about Jackie Brown that you love so much?
Oh, man, where to start? I mean, I love Jackie Brown so much that on a usual Friday night at Penn State College, I'd rather be in a room talking about Jackie Brown than being outside with the people.
Very good.
Like people partying in the commons room that are looking at me as I'm talking into my Skype as if I'm talking to some person here, but there's no one here, so I'm talking to myself in general. But, you know, Jackie Brown is a very fascinating thing because out of all the films of Quentin Tarantino, it is the one that sticks with me the most. You know, of course, we have our beloved classics like Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, and the new modernist stuff like Django and Glorious Bastards. But there's something about Jackie Brown that feels so much more humane and so much more just raw with emotion and character that you hardly forget, or at times you forget that it's actually by Quentin Tarantino, because up to this point, we've just been used to seeing him go in the ultra-violent kind of aspects with these really insane characters of life, larger-than-life characters, and very vivid, lovely dialogue that it's weird to see him turn another corner and just reinvent himself with this kind of movie that, while in a sense stays along those lines of a Tarantino film with the dialogue and the characters and his usual cast member Samuel Jackson returning into another great role as Ordell, it has a much more unique feel to it. It feels like you're watching a human drama, which you normally wouldn't associate Tarantino with, yet he's so good with creating drama within characters that I think it's something we overlook when it comes to Tarantino, besides the great dialogue and awesome violence.
Yeah, I agree with you, because Jackie Brown's always been but Jackie Brown's always been like my favorite Tarantino movie.
Oh, same here.
And I think that's due to a couple of factors. I used to say it's like Tarantino's most mature movie, but I hate saying that now because I don't necessarily think that's true, because every single one of his movies are mature.
Oh, yeah.
I think probably what sets Jackie Brown apart from the rest of his filmography is that this is the only film of his that has like a cohesive narrative structure. And I think that's partly due to being based on an Elmore Leonard novel, but I don't think it's limited to that. I think, because I've read Rum Punch, I think Rum Punch is good. I like Elmore Leonard a lot. I've read a lot of his stuff, but Jackie Brown is completely different than Rum Punch. Rum Punch just it has the basis outline and a lot of the character names, but I mean Jackie Brown's white in Rum Punch, and there's a lot of differences between it. And another thing I've always loved is this might be my favorite Tarantino cast too.
Oh, definitely.
You know, the fact that he uses. The fact that he uses Robert Forster, Pam Grier, obviously Samuel Jackson, who's great in everything.
Oh, yeah.
And great as a Tarantino player. But he also uses Bridget Fonda, and I really, really, really love Robert De Niro and Michael Keaton in this movie.
Oh, they're so fantastic in this movie.
Not to mention that I think that Max Cherry is certainly my my favorite Tarantino character. And I think almost every character that this guy creates are fantastic. And all of his main characters have been fantastic. But there's something so alluring about Robert Forster as Max Cherry. You know, the guy's just the ultimate, he's just stoicism is what Max Cherry represents. And I've always, always, always loved that character so much.
It's funny because, you know, one thing we also know about Tarantino is that he loves to just pick out favorite actors from the movies that he grew up with. And he wants to almost like reinvent their careers. You know, he did it with John Travolta, and you know, and now with this film, he did it with both Pam Grier and Robert Forster, who've had, you know, at least Robert Forster, who's now in a lot of movies nowadays. Pam Grier, it's a tragedy that she isn't utilized more in TV and movies. But you know, yeah, Robert Forster, it's just such an understated performance that it doesn't draw attention to itself. Yet, with every eye movement or whenever he glances at something, you can tell there's just a lot of stuff going on underneath, but he doesn't feel the need to, you know, show it externally. You can just feel it by his presence, the way he talks, and just the way he stands around Jackie Brown when he is really getting into her, when he really is kind of in love with her.
Yeah, I think. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's a really it's a subtle performance, and it's a performance that's, like you said, it's in the eyes and it's in his body language and it's the way he moves and sort of the way his quiet disposition about things. And he doesn't really, you know, I was watching the movie. I watched it earlier this week. I watched it, you know, and when I'm watching it again for like probably the, you know, 10th or 11th time or whatever it is, you really see how, you know, close to the vest Robert Forster played the character, never went over the top and never went like, you know, it was just very, the trajectory of the role and the level of his, you know, Tarantino's characters are so larger than life a lot of times, and they're boisterous and they're huge. And here, this, of the movie is this quiet older guy who, you said, is basically falling in love with somebody right before his eyes, someone who he never expected to fall in love with. And it's like that tenderness of the character extends throughout the whole picture. And the fact that I think that this is something that was not based on an original script by Tarantino, that sort of kept him in a particular, you know, realm that where he couldn't stray too far in order to be, to still, you know, pay respect to the source novel. So, it, you know, in some instances you can kind of say, well, Tarantino was working with somebody else's, you know, framework. So he had to sort of, you know, he had to sort of stay within that world and not go too crazy.
Yeah. There's something where in Tarantino characters, they're very vocal. They just command the screen whenever they come on. You know, you can just feel it coming off the screen, just the presence. But with, you know, Robert Forster, so what's so amazing about his performance is that he doesn't draw attention to himself. He really is a very meek person.
Yeah, his performance is very, as Nick was saying, he's very subtle in the film, and he does a lot of his acting. It's a lot of physical acting. It's a lot of reaction.
Yeah.
It's a lot of eye movements. It's small facial movements. It's his posture. It's his body language, and I think that's what makes it so remarkable. Because, you know, so many of Tarantino's characters are so over the top.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you think of his best characters, in particularly Christoph Waltz. The past couple of years, I mean, how over the top is Christoph Waltz? But it's over the top to a perfect T.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, that's why I love Forrester, and that's why I even love Robert De Niro and Jackie Brown, because De Niro is so low key.
He's so amazing in this. It's like, I did not realize that's Robert De Niro from Goodfellas, but here he's like playing like second banana to Samuel L. Jackson, and he's so perfect.
Yeah, I love seeing De Niro in the film. Love his interactions with Bridget Fonda. Love seeing him get all like stony with her on the couch. And it's like the total opposite of, you know, certainly then too, like, you know, this is before De Niro started to like spoof his persona in the comedies and everything. And, you know, this was one of those instances where, you know, Tarantino was smart enough to know that you'd bring in your, you know, crime movie related baggage with De Niro. And then he sort of subverts your expectations and turns him, like you said, into like a second banana, a guy who's there for more for color and more for, you know, surprise than anything else. I mean, when he, I mean, obviously we're going to, you know, full spoilers, no problems. Whoever's listening to this podcast clearly will have seen the movie. When he executes Bridget Fonda in the parking lot, it is just so chilling because, like, you've spent this time with this guy who seems like, you know, he sort of seems like the kind of guy that, like, you know, got, he says that I got arrested for doing a bank robbery, right?
Yeah.
And you have to put the pieces together a little bit about maybe what was going on in that bank robbery. What kind of guy is this guy? And you like pick up these small clues throughout the movie that, you know, he's not 100% there, if you know what I mean. And when he turns on a dime and shoots her because she just won't stop talking, I can remember seeing that in the theater the first time and just being like, wow, that's just so, it's just so chilling and so nasty and so evil. And you forget that this guy is totally fucking evil. And the fact that he's just been placated because he's been out of prison and looking to get high and drunk and, you know, get his rocks off with her. That's, you know, he's just been using her the whole movie. And, you know, that's something I don't think that you expect with that character, the way that it's been set up. He's like kind of like this bumbling guy, like, you know,
yeah, like there's that point where that point where he's trying to open Ordell's car in the beginning and he's like trying to figure out how to work the keys and he's just like, this guy is so out of his element here, but yet he's such you see that stone cold killerness, like right when he like looks at Bridget Fonda and he's like so angry with her because she won't stop pissing him off about where the car is parked.
You can, the disgust in his face is paramount.
It is so I love it.
Just the utter disgust, like the ultimate De Niro scowl.
And he makes that fist to her. He's like, I'm going to knock your fucking ass.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, my God. That's the real De Niro we know.
Yeah, and that's what's so great. That's why I love Tarantino and his casting. Because from what I've read, when he approached both Michael Keaton and De Niro about taking parts in the film, they both wanted to play Max Cherry.
Oh.
And Tarantino's like, no, like Max Cherry's for
Robert
Forrester. It's like, it's, I think I think next to Pam Grier being cast as Jackie Brown, that was probably the second or third casting, right away. But I think that's interesting that both Keaton and De Niro wanted to play the Max Cherry part, because I think that's, Max Cherry is probably the best role in the film.
Oh, definitely.
Best character in the film. And I will say I do love Michael Keaton for how you know, he's probably the most over the top character, or I should say over the top performance in the film. Just with his fast movements and his leather jacket.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just, dude, he's just so cool in the movie.
So awesome, so cool.
He's so cool.
And I love how that character was extended in other films. Like, it's one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah, how he was in Out of Sight. That's so awesome. I do love that. I think that is very cool that they were able to do that,
mm-hmm.
considering the films were made from two different studios.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even interesting how he brings in, like, a small-time, like, Chris Tucker for, like, that one amazing scene. And it's like, you would think that, oh, it's Chris Tucker. He's going to be in this movie for a while. Oh, no. He's disposed of right immediately, and it's like, but he knows how to use his actors well. He has a specific purpose for them, and he doesn't overextend their boundaries, and he knows just what he wants, and that's just so amazing with Tarantino when it comes to his casting and just the kinds of actors he's able to get for these really rich roles that, you know, for someone like Chris Tucker, I think that's one of his best performances, and that's saying a lot because he just – it's not the manic Chris Tucker. It's not like the manic one we get in the Rush Hour. It's a more like really scared out of his mind because here's Ordell who's just bailed him out of jail and asking him to do something in Chinatown. It's just,
And he knows that it's like, he knows that nothing's good is going to come out of this situation. But at the same time, you know that he's like still a good enough guy to be like, all right, this guy's done me a solid. I got to do it. He's not going to stop bothering me. Let me just do it. But yeah, no, I agree. Like Chris Tucker, I've always liked the guy. I thought he was a funny dude. He's a smart guy. He can be dramatic. He just doesn't want to work, it seems. Like the stories that I heard when I was out in L.A. and that I've read online about the guy, he just seems very content to chill out and not do much from what I gather. But, you know, don't know the guy, so I couldn't, you know, not 100% sure.
Oh, yeah.
But that role is just so awesome. Like, he comes into that movie for 10 minutes and just kills it. And he's hysterical. And he's, like, stoned, like, really stoned during that sequence with Samuel Jackson's. He's not quite thinking straight. And I love the interaction between the two of them. It's really funny stuff.
Yeah, and what, Samuel Jackson lures him out with the promise of going to some
chicken and waffles,
some place to get chicken and waffles. I mean, it's collard greens.
Yeah,
I can just see it now.
And the decision, you know, the artistic decision to have the idea that, like, okay, so you're coming off the heels of the splattery violence of Pulp Fiction, samurai swords, you know, the craziness in the basement, the multiple people getting shot, you know. So your people's expectations are one thing. No one would have expected the execution of Chris Tucker to have taken place with a crane shot from a football field away, done in like the most just cold way ever. Like, yeah, just the whole sequence, how the camera just picks up into the sky, goes and looks over into that shitty lot where Samuel Jackson pulls that car over and then just, you know, opens up the trunk, pop, pop, and then you hear the music come back on when he gets back in his car. It's just, for me, that's one of the best, that's like one of the best directed scenes like Tarantino's ever done. Like, from the idea of it to how it was executed out, to the confidence to do that and to subvert your expectations. Because what? Like, at this point, you're in the movie, you're waiting for the first kill, you're at the new Tarantino movie at the time. Again, you know, expectations are, you know, at the time they can be, you know, a big disappointment for people. And sometimes, you know, a happy surprise. I just don't think that anybody expected that movie to be, you know, as reserved. You know, I know Frankie said you don't like to call it, you know, his most mature movie. You know, I can see what you're saying there, but at the same time, you know, I think that there is a level of maturity in that movie that sort of goes against the grain with a lot of some of his other stuff. And I think that the reason why I feel that way is because it's not his original work. And I think that he wanted to, he changing the race of the character, you know, that was his way of spicing things up, doing something different, you know. But I think that he wanted to pay as much respect to Elmore Leonard as he could, but while still making it a Quentin Tarantino picture, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I agree. And I just want to circle back to real quick when you were talking about the Chris Tucker's death scene. What makes that so great also is that it's queued up to Johnny Cash's Tennessee Stud.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah, I believe so, yes.
Which, you know, is fantastic. And, you know, not to mention that every single one of Tarantino's soundtracks are amazing. I own every single one of them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I can't think of too many directors that have as good a soundtracks as his films. The only others that come to mind for use of popular music would be Paul Thomas Anderson to a certain extent, even though over the past couple of years he's made period piece films with the Johnny Greenwood score, which are great. But I think that Scorsese might be the only other director that I think is on the level of Tarantino with using popular music. And I hate to say the term popular music, but, you know, like vintage popular music or music from the 70s and the 80s and stuff like that, and maybe even earlier.
It's like an eclectic taste. He just knows what song, like how Scorsese shoots with his movies, where he has a specific song in mind, so he directs a scene according to a song. It's almost how probably Tarantino, where he just has all these songs queued up in his memory, and he's like, this is this this is like the perfect kind of song to go with this scene, and it's going to make it even better.
Yeah, I mean, that scene between my favorite scene in the movie is at the end when Ordell and Max are riding to his bail bonds place,
oh, yeah.
And Ordell's driving his car, and he looks down, and he pushes the cassette tape in, and it's the Delphonics, and
yep.
He's like, I didn't know you liked the Delphonics. Max Cherry's like, yeah, they're pretty good.
They're pretty good.
And, you know, what other music would be as perfect for that scene? I can't think of anything else. You're right. I mean, it's the guy picks music with the intent of it being injected into the screenplay, into the film. And, you know, when I was at film school and I thought I was going to be the next Tarantino and I was trying to write all these screenplays, I would always put music in my screenplays, and then my screenplay instructor would always yell at me for doing that. I was like, well, Tarantino does it, so fuck
exactly.
You.
Exactly.
Who are you to tell me I'm not going to put music in my screenplay? Because, you know, I've read Tarantino screenplays that are probably some of the most unorthodox screenplays I've ever read. But, yeah, it's just like, man, that popular music. I'll tell you what, when I saw fucking Inglourious Basterds in theaters and all of a sudden Cat People starts playing, I freaked out.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. I loved that moment.
And then Django Unchained, when the Jim Croce song starts playing to this, like, montage of the winner of them killing all these people.
Pretty much.
Oh, my God. And I don't know what it is, and I don't want to know, but I've heard from a few people who have seen Hateful Eight already that there's a scene in the film where he injects a 70s pop song into it. So I think that's amazing that he's kind of keeping up with the theme of making these period piece films, but injecting popular music into them as sort of a, I don't know. I don't even know what you would call it. Maybe like a chapter break in a way. Kind of like Lars von Trier and Breaking the Waves.
I think it's if Quentin Tarantino taught a history class and he's like, forget everything you know about history. This is how it happened. You know, Eli Roth broke down the theater door and he blew up Hitler's face with a machine gun.
Right.
And we had a guy named Django in the 1800s who was killing plantation owners, and there was Samuel Jackson in the background somewhere, and, you know, it all worked out in the end. But there's also another fascinating thing, like compared to Jackie Brown, like, when you talk about the violence, you know, what makes that Beaumont execution scene is that it's so far away and we know what's going to happen. And when it does happen, it leaves an eerie feeling, like it's not something to be celebrated about. It's just like this guy
yeah.
just fucking executed some guy who didn't even know about it. And throughout the film, like the violence is not like in a showy, stylized way like you would in Django Unchained or Inglourious Basterds, because that's more to be entertained about. But in here, the violence has a consequence to it that we haven't really
yeah.
seen any other Tarantino film.
Yeah, it's quick, it's lethal, it's very cold. You know, when De Niro gets his in the van, that's like just you're just like whoa, like
whoa.
In the way that that
yeah,
like the way that that shot from behind and the blood just splatters all over the front windshield. You know, everything about the film, the way that he sort of switched, it was a smart move. I think that at the end of the day, he knew that it would have been unwise for Quentin Tarantino to essentially try to make Pulp Fiction 2. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that as a legit, like as a literal sequel, but, you know, like I think that if he had tried to go down that well again, people would have been so ready to, you know, hold him to task, you know, to call him a one trick pony.
Oh yeah.
And I think that when Jackie Brown came out, I think that people were like, yeah, this is a really good movie, but it's not what I thought it was going to be, or it's not exactly what, you know, I'm expecting from Tarantino. And I think that like it received solid reviews, excellent reviews from most people. It did well enough at the box office, but I think it's one of those movies that over time, you know, it's really shown its endurance as a really, really, I mean, like, next, for me, my two favorite movies are Pulp from Tarantino or Pulp Fiction and this one. Pulp Fiction for me is just like a life changer. When I saw it in the theater, I was 14 years old and it completely blew my mind. I'd never seen anything like it before. remotely even close. And I just, it opened my eyes to cinema in a way that few films, Natural Born Killers, is another one, Goodfellas, Heat, those kind of movies. But Pulp Fiction really just set my world on fire. And I had just no idea really what I was getting into. And much of it went over my head. I would be lying if I said that I grasped that entire movie, when I first saw it the first time. But Jackie Brown is just it's just the wonderful 180 from Pulp Fiction. And I think that it really shows the strength and the range of Tarantino, who has gotten really comfortable telling his outsized homage, half homage, half, original, all original. But if you know what I mean, he's been riffing on genre elements now for so long.
Oh, yeah.
And doing it through his unique prism and his own amazing style of violence and dialogue. But when you look back at something like Jackie Brown, it feels so quaint and it feels so reserved by comparison.
First I want to say, I just looked this up. For anybody who collects vinyl soundtracks or vinyls in general, I know there's a lot of people, I do. The Jackie Brown soundtrack is getting a release on vinyl October 6th, which is very cool.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I have Pulp Fiction on vinyl. Huh?
That seems long overdue, but I guess now the vinyl is back, so.
Yeah, the hipsters. I guess that's the one good thing from hipsters, is they brought vinyl back.
Good for that.
So, yeah, I know. But the one thing I hate more than anything are the Tarantino haters. And, the people that are just, out for blood. I get that people don't like Tarantino films. That's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an acquired taste to a certain extent, but I think he's become more broad-ranged as he's gotten older. And
yeah.
I think Inglourious Basterds and Django kind of reinvented the wheel for him, both commercially and to a broader range of people. But, there's just people that all the, whenever Tarantino gets brought up, they'll get on that train of, all the guy does is rip shit off from other movies and he can't make anything original. And it's I think most great filmmakers show a lot of homage in their films to filmmakers and films that came prior that influenced their careers.
Yeah.
But the thing about Tarantino is, there is not another director alive that loves film more than him.
Absolutely.
I feel, I guess Scorsese and there's a lot of other people, but I mean, Tarantino is the epitome of a film geek with a camera.
Pretty much.
I mean, this guy has no classical training. I mean, Scorsese went to NYU. So many other people are well educated or went to film school.
He started off in a video store.
Exactly. Yeah. He worked at a video store and he wanted to make movies that he wanted to see.
Exactly.
And thank fucking God that happened. Because I can't think of cinema without Tarantino.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a very difference between just paying it a homage and just clearly ripping off. And Tarantino, he pays homage because whenever he does these little homages, he makes it his own. Like when you watch Reservoir Dogs, the names of Mr. Black, Mr. Pink, those are all just taken from the taking of Pelham 1-2-3. But it's he's paying homage to a film he loves, and he still gets to make it his own. So it's not like he's ripping off at all.
Right, and he's not even being sneaky with ripping stuff off. I mean, just think of the scores he's used.
Exactly.
He uses Once Upon a Time in the West tracks in Kill Bill.
Yeah.
It's like he's not trying to hide it.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he's in love. He's in love with cinema. He's in love with the possibilities that it affords him as an artist. He's open to he's open to taking things that he loved in one era and applying them to another. And, there's a lot of jealousy out there. There's a lot of people who, Tarantino represents to them the ultimate sort of, like you said, the ultimate geek success. He's everybody's dream. It's every film geek's dream come true is to get a chance to, make your movies and your movies only. I mean, that's the other thing too about Tarantino. It's every other filmmaker from Scorsese to fucking Spielberg. I mean, Fincher. I don't care who you are. You could point to Fincher. You could point to every single major filmmaker. Soderbergh. I mean, I don't care who they are. They've all made a picture for them.
Yep.
If you know what I mean.
Oh yeah.
Like I'll make one for you. Then you can make one. Then you'll let me make one for me. That's never happened with Quentin Tarantino.
Never.
Quentin Tarantino has only made the movies that he wants to make. He's right. not interested
right. in anything else.
Terrence Malick is the only other one I can think of.
Kubrick, Malick, Tarantino.
Yeah, Kubrick, Malick, you know, Tarantino.
But, I mean, I think the only concession that Tarantino has probably ever made is putting Brad Pitt in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah,
because
that might have been.
Think about the time frame. I mean, he does the Kill Bills. He kind of disappears for a while. He does Grindhouse, which I loved. But that was just a bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just a total economic and critical failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he just didn't really do much for a while, and then he wants to make Inglourious Basterds, and it's like, it's going to cost a ton of money, and it's gigantic, and, you know, well, all right, I'll get Brad Pitt to secure studio financing when Brad Pitt's not even really the star of the movie. He's top billed and he's great and he's on all the cover art, he's on all the posters, he's in all the trailers. But I would probably imagine that he's the only concession. Because, I mean, look at Django Unchained. He wanted Will Smith for the part. Will Smith didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And he dusts off Jamie Foxx, who was just in obscurity.
Pretty much.
And gives him the lead role. Of course, Christoph Waltz winning the Oscar for Inglourious Basterds certainly helped with, you know, having you know what's interesting, though, not to get too off track, I always looked at Hans Landa as the main character of Inglourious Basterds.
The same here. I've always looked at him as the main character.
And I'll throw this out here because I love getting into debates/arguments with people about this. I think Hans Landa is like the epitome of an anti-hero.
I would almost agree there. Very much so.
Or what do you think, Nick? Or do you think he's like the straight-up villain?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. I certainly think that he's the villain of the piece, but at the same time, there are these weird moments where I don't know if you find yourself connecting with the guy, but you sort of like kind of like in Seven, where you understand the method to somebody's madness, if you will.
Yeah, that's scary.
You know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that John Doe says in the back of that car, but I can understand where he's coming from, and I can certainly see how there'd be people like that out there who would feel that way. So in that instance, yes, there is more to it than just being a black and white villain. It's more shaded. You know, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, but he ends the war.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, for his own selfish reasons.
Exactly. For his selfish
reasons. He knows it's over, and he wants to be billed as a hero. But, like, you know, he ends the war. He doesn't kill old girl at the beginning of the movie when, you know, he obviously probably could have shot her.
See,
as impossible of a shot that would have been. But, I mean, he's chivalrous.
Yeah, and I always looked at him as, he's a person that has to fit with the times. It's like, look, I got two options. I can be a runaway from the Nazi party, or I could join them and, you know, lead a better life. And look, shit, I don't like doing it, but I got to do it. You know, there's nothing else I can do here. So, you know, Pete, you got the short straw, buddy. I'm going to have to turn you in or kill you. But it's like when opportunity strikes, you're like, hey, man, I could probably kill Hitler and get in the war tonight. And it's like, fuck it, I'll take it.
You know, and also, like, he doesn't kill the farmer at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah, no.
You know what I mean? Like, he keeps his word. It's like, you tell me where they're at, down in your cellar, I'm going to not do anything to you and your daughters, and I'm going to go about my way. And, you know, he's just, thank God Quentin Tarantino found Christoph Waltz.
I know, thank God.
You want to talk about the ultimate fucking discovery?
Christoph Waltz.
I mean, Jesus Christ. That guy, and then fuck all the people that say he wins the Oscar for playing the same character, because, like, yeah, he does, but, like, no.
No.
Because King Schultz is the fucking hero.
Yeah.
Of Django Unchained. But anyway, I don't want to get too, like, I don't want to bounce around too terribly much, but back to, you know, Daniel Brühl's character, I think, is worse than Hans Landa in Inglourious Bastards.
I can kind of see that.
Where you think he's, like, the nice guy, and, like, yeah, he's, like, the sniper that killed all these people, and he just wants to, like, you know, start a relationship with her until he gets aggressive and she kills him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And then it's kind of like, oh, you are a piece of shit.
But hey, man, if it's Melanie Laurent, I'll be a piece of shit and get killed over if it gets me a nut. Come on, I can't deny me that.
No, I agree.
I guess speaking of characters, the one character we have not even touched on is Pam fucking Greer as penultimate. Like, I swear to God, I don't say this a lot. I've only said it maybe three times in my lifetime, but her not getting a Best Actress nomination, I feel, was a direct snub, because she fucking is like the ultimate female heroine, because here she is. She's a black woman in her 40s. She has to outwit everyone in this male authoritative world. And not only does she get away with it, but the person that she is kind of in love with, like, they both accept it to a point that it's only platonic. Like, there's not going to be a romantic relationship. We're not going to ride off in the sunset. We both have our own ways, and that's that. And it's like, that feels so fucking refreshing. Like, when was the last time when the two leads that were romantically involved, they just were like, hey, man, we don't have to go serious.
They have a love that's too pure.
Yeah, it's so pure. And, like, they have that simple, that beautiful, simple kiss. And it's not even over-sexualized. Like, they don't, like, go tonguing each other. It's like a simple kiss. And it's like, that's so fucking beautiful. Like, I've never seen Tarantino capture something that amazing on screen as any other director has had than him. I mean, that was so fucking beautiful.
Yeah, the ending is, like, heartbreakingly beautiful.
Oh.
Where it's just, like, so sad. It's like, dude, just, like, go with her. You know you want to go with her. She wants you to go with her, but it's like, no, I'm gonna just stay here and live my shitty life with my business and my money.
Exactly.
And just
patience, like the patience that Tarantino shows as a filmmaker and as a storyteller at the end, the last 10 minutes of that movie, where other filmmakers might be rushing to close or to get that final beat and be done, and rather than skate through it after the final confrontation with Saxon and everything else, you get that awesome introspective moment for Forster when then he turns his back to the camera and he walks out of focus, which is just so awesome. And then you sit with Pam Greer in the car, much like you sat with her or walked with her or dollied along with her in the beginning at the airport, and you get into her mental headspace again. Like, in the beginning of the movie, you don't know this woman, you don't know what's going on, but, like, Tarantino wants you in her headspace for 3 minutes with that song playing in that, you know, airport terminal. And it's the same way at the end. You've come to know this woman, she's going to drive, you know, she's in her car, she's trying to figure her stuff out, you know, all this stuff has happened. And that, for me, is one of the things that separates sort of Jackie Brown from his other work, is that it was a more humanistic, sort of a more introspective movie. And like you said, dealing with 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, Pam Grier really was robbed. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, in 1997, unfortunately, I don't think that the Academy was – you know, they've gotten a little bit better over the years, I feel like, with recognizing some more edgy work and some more, hip is the word for it. But, you know, just I don't think that they understood the importance of, a Pam Greer and all these, you know, somebody like that being resurrected, you know, who had that very specific career that she had in the 60s and 70s. I don't think that there was sort of like the respect there at all. And it should have been.
I agree. I mean, at least, but I mean, at the very least, At least she was nominated for
Globe.
A Globe and a Screen Actors
Guild. Yeah, that to me was like even more appalling. It's like, wow, you got a SAG and a Globe, but yet didn't get the Oscar. Like, that's like almost like a perfect clear pathway to do it.
Did Jackie Brown get any Oscar nominations?
Just Robert Forster. That's a
Forster for supporting actor, not even for adapted screenplay.
Nope.
Right.
Wow. See, and again, I mean, again, that was like, you know, Titanic and L.A. Confidential were battling it out. I mean, I remember I saw Jackie Brown and Titanic on the same day. I saw Titanic in the morning with my father and my mother. And then later that night, my dad and I went to see Jackie Brown.
That's a double feature.
I know, right? And I'm just thinking about it. Another great double feature I had of Tarantino double feature. I saw Star Trek Generations. And then with my parents, saw Star Trek Generations with my parents, and then we ran from the theater to Pulp Fiction and had no time in between, zero time. Yeah, Pulp Fiction was a watch with your parents in the theater type experience for me. That was awesome.
That was amazing. It's funny, but, I was just saying, like, it's funny how you were, like, what, 14 when you saw Pulp Fiction? And,
yes.
And I was actually 14 when I first saw Pulp Fiction, but I didn't have the luxury of seeing it in a theater. But it's really interesting how Tarantino can catch on to these, like, newer viewers that are very young that didn't get the chance to see, like, something like a Pulp Fiction or know its, like, cultural relevance.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a grindhouse movie was way, 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 way far gone for me. I didn't grow up. Like, that's what's always been so interesting for me with Tarantino, and especially stuff like Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, and to a certain degree, Grindhouse, the thing he did with Robert Rodriguez, which I felt was just too up its own ass for, I think, the wide populace. I think that they overestimated what the acceptance level would be from people for that type of material. Right. I didn't grow up watching those movies. So when I was presented with something like Grindhouse, it went like, I just didn't appreciate it. I really didn't enjoy that movie on first glance. I've come to like it more now because I realize what he was attempting to do, and because I got a little bit more savvy with my viewing selections, and I understood what it was that he was, you know, paying respect, paying homage, and riffing on.
At the same time, though, like, Death Proof is his worst movie. I like Death Proof, but the second half of it, I just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, the entire second act of that movie, I almost tune out because I don't really care about what's going on.
Exactly.
I mean, the first act is fucking incredible.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, Kurt Russell in the bar talking to Rose McGowan and everybody's getting drunk, and then that head-on collision with Kurt Russell's fucking great in that movie.
Awesome.
I mean, dude, Stuntman Mike, oh, he gives me a chubby with that icy hot jacket and that huge scar and that, like, Elvis hairdo.
It was awesome.
You know, but the first act is amazing. The second act I pretty much tune out of. And the third act is good, like the chase, and then when, like, they chase him down and they shoot him and he starts crying.
Yeah.
And he just turns, and Stuntman Mike just turns into a total bitch, and then they kill him, I think is awesome. But I also think a part of the issue with that was, you're right, like, they were too far up their own ass with that, which I still love it. And I love the Machete movies. I really like what Robert Rodriguez does. But I also think at the same time, Planet Terror is vastly superior to Death Proof.
Yeah, me too.
I think Planet Terror is incredible.
I remember liking Planet Terror enough in the theater to be like, all right, this is wild, this is crazy, like, this is kind of fun. And then
we get to see the Tarantino movie that we've been waiting for the whole, like, hour and a half of Planet Terror.
It just wasn't.
And then the Tarantino movie just underwhelms.
And you had those great trailers in between, you know?
Like, oh, yeah.
That kind of stole the thunder from, like, both movies in a certain respect. But getting, you know, again, not to get too far off track, but getting back to Jackie Brown, I think that one of the things that has made that movie sort of as long lasting as it is, and I think that one of the things that has brought people back to it, is that it's the kind of movie where the violence isn't as off as potentially off-putting. And I think that it is just, it's just a classically well-told story, like you said, Frank, that feels more cohesive and while still nonlinear enough, it feels more dialed down for people. And I think that that's one of the reasons why maybe that movie has had such a long life on DVD and Blu-ray and, home viewing watchings.
It's something you can really get yourself involved with because it's really an awesome heist movie where you're just trying to like outmaneuver these criminals and these cops for a lot of money. And it's something you can really, attach your teeth on and just really cling to for like 2.5 hours. And, the story, it's well tight. There's like not a single crack in this entire ship. Like everything is well hinged. And there's a certain level of tension when they actually do the exchange that you don't know what's going to happen because Tarantino is always a step ahead of his audience in what they're going to expect. And he knows that, okay, I've laid out this elaborate heist, but I'm going to turn it on its head and I'm going to make it even more convoluted, but yet you can still understand where it's going.
Oh, certainly. And the reason I hate to say that it's his most mature movie is because I just don't want the word mature to be taken out of context, as in his other films are immature.
Reserved.
Reserved, yeah. Jackie Brown certainly stands on its own in his filmography.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting where he's went from Jackie Brown, especially since, he made Inglourious Basterds, then Django, and now he's making Hateful Eight, which those three movies are certainly cut from the same cloth. The period piece, fictional alternate history, I suppose.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see if he ever kind of circles back to a Jackie Brown. I don't think he's gonna retire anytime soon, like he's been threatening for the past 10 years. I don't think he could. What else would he do? I think he loves what he does.
Oh yeah, and I always like. Yeah, there is a lot of maturity to his films nowadays. I guess the phase I would best describe him as, this is like his itchy and scratchy phase, where he's really making these overly violent, exploitative kind of films in which people are just getting blown up to bits and he's having fun. You can really enjoy yourself. But yeah, there's like something that Jackie Brown, it doesn't feel like, I don't know if it's adult is the right word, but you just feel a level of, there's just something about it. There's like this allure of, There's a human drama here that is happening in the middle of this heist film, but yet at the same time he wants to do this like 70s blaxploitation kind of style movie that he wants to pay homage to, and he's casting these really great black actors and actresses, and he's really having fun with the time period, especially with the music, and the cinematography is done by Guillermo Navarro, who works with Guillermo del Toro a lot. It's just a really interesting combination. Like there's also like these long tracking shots where he's just having conversation play out, in which a usual Tarantino is just more edited and fast paced, and you can really just like feel the energy in the scene. But here it's a lot. Yeah. Like you guys said, it's very reserved. It's going at a steady pace. It's not in a hurry to get anywhere. And that's what I love about Tarantino. He has the ability to do movies like this and no one's going to tell him to say no.
Yeah, it's interesting how the recent stuff, the recent Tarantino has looked so different because he's been shooting with, been working with Robert Richardson, and, the earlier stuff, Guillermo, I know Navarro shot Jackie Brown. He also shot Pulp Fiction, if I'm not mistaken.
I think. I have to double check that.
No, he didn't.
Oh.
Who shot Pulp Fiction?
Hang on. Let me look. Keep going, though. I'll check.
I've only seen it a million times. But no, his visual aesthetic has changed, like, completely. It's been – you can tell. I mean, the new versus the old Tarantino, if you will. I think working with
Robert – Andreas Sekula?
Sekula, yes, that's right. Andreas Sekula, yes, that's right. I just think that working with Robert Richardson has sort of opened him up into like this new sort of like not overly photogenic, but just like there's a more studied quality, I think, to the visuals that he's been when he's been working with Robert Richardson, because I think Richardson comes from such a deep background.
You feel like you're watching an epic with like Inglourious Basterds or in Django Unchained. You feel like, wow, I'm in this universe that he's transporting me back in time. And there's just, the photography is luscious. There's a so crisp and so beautiful looking that it's like, wow, I can just appreciate the imagery, like the visual imagery along with what's happening in the action and such. There's just, yeah, with Robert Richardson, I think he is able to elevate his new phase in his career with, you know, a cinematographer of that kind of caliber.
Yeah, not to mention, like, I think the underlying themes of Django Unchained I really loved. I mean, I think that a perfect double bill would be 12 Years a Slave and Django Unchained. Honestly, I mean, you'd get the heaviness of 12 Years a Slave and make you feel terrible about humans and and what, you know, what our history is. And then you put in Django Unchained and you just watch like Django take the power back, which is amazing.
If only Michael Fassbender was in it, then I'd be more really satisfied.
Right? You know, and you know what's awesome is I always forget Fassbender's in
Inglourious Basterds.
Inglourious Basterds, because that movie is so big. I always forget that he's in that.
He's such a chameleon in that movie. It's like, oh my god, that's Michael Fassbender.
I know, he does like the ultimate David Niven impression in that movie.
That damn, that's good scotch.
Yeah, I think he's great in that. I remember, I don't know when it was. My mom has always not ever wanted to watch a Quentin Tarantino movie, like, her entire life. She just would refuse. She would just refuse to watch a Tarantino movie with me. And it was, like, last year. I think it was, like, on Easter or something. She was over for some holiday. And I just put on Django Unchained and didn't even tell her. That was, like, my mom's first experience into a Tarantino movie, and she absolutely loved it.
That's awesome.
And I think that's like a testament to Tarantino as a filmmaker, because she thought it was just going to be this ultra-violent, like, bullshit movie, which it is ultra-violent, but, I mean, she really did enjoy it, and she wanted to watch it again, and now she kind of wants to see his other films. So we haven't really made it past Django Unchained, but she does want to see Hateful Eight, so I think we're going to go see that on Christmas. So looking forward to that.
And it's like a really interesting, like, you know, when – how we discussed this is from a novel by Elmore Leonard, and you know, we're always curious about, will Tarantino ever go back to another written material? And I don't really think so. I think he's in this phase of his career where he, you know, he does realize he's getting old, so he wants to work on stuff that he wants, that he's created, not someone else that's created. And it's a really fascinating thing about how the one movie that he adapted from was, of all the films, Jackie Brown, which is nothing like his other movies. And you know, I think there is a framework that he wants to respect Elmore Leonard, but at that same time, he still makes it his own movie. And, you know, how Jackie Brown in the novel was white, but he wanted to work with Pam Grier so badly because he just, you know, he adored her so much from those 70s movies like Foxy Brown and Coffee, just playing these black vigilante kind of heroes that, you know, there's like the really interesting story about how when Pam Grier came into his office, he had all these posters of her in her 70s style movies, and she's like, oh, that's flattering. And he's like, actually, I was going to take them down because I thought I'd be embarrassed with having them up. Like, he just adored her so much that he just has all these posters of her in his office.
Yeah, Pam Grier's awesome. I was fortunate enough to meet her one time, and she signed my Jackie Brown Blu-ray.
Oh,
and
that's so awesome.
I bought her memoir, Foxy, and she signed that. And then I had her sign my DVD copy of A Decade Under the Influence, which, if people haven't seen that, it's one of the best documentaries you'll ever see. It was a three-part IFC documentary that Ted Demme did, talking about the films of the late 60s and mainly the 70s, The Decade Under the Influence. And, I mean, they interviewed, like, Scorsese, Clint Eastwood, Pam Grier, Roy Scheider, Bruce Dern, I mean...
It's an extreme.
William Friedkin, Coppola. It's one of the best. It's one of the. It's the best documentary you'll ever see on that era of cinema.
Huh.
So
I'll definitely check that one out.
Yeah, it's great, man. Oh, it's fantastic. It's like
amazing. You'll love it. It's great. And you know, I think that when you think about Tarantino and like what the next steps for the future could be, I think that it's like anything. I think anything's possible. I could easily see him continuing in the same sort of grand operatic mode that he's been in of late with these sort of big idea movies, big canvas movies. But at the same time, nothing would surprise me and see him go back to a more controlled sort of modern, you know, crime, you know, milieu that, you know, something that we've seen before, but maybe in a different way. I would personally love to see that, you know, get down and dirty again, and gritty with a, some sort of crime, you know, heist thriller, you know, something like that. But, I think that the thing that's so cool about Tarantino is that the passion doesn't really matter what the project is. Yeah. There's always just so much passion involved. And, you know, guys like Scorsese and, you know, guys like, you know, Oliver Stone and De Palma and Spielberg, you know, these are the filmmakers, you know, that I always think about when I think about who really truly love movies, you know, guys who just eat, drink, breathe, and sleep movies. You know that the movies are on their brain all day long, and it's all they think about. And Tarantino, you know, has got to be at the very top of that list because it's just, you know, he's the ultimate, you know, walking, talking movie encyclopedia that got a chance to, you know, put all of his, you know, obsessions and all of his desires up on the big screen. And that's really exciting that, you know, if there could only be one Quentin Tarantino, I'm glad that he was able to find his way into the movie world instead of just sitting behind the video, you know, counter his whole life. Because I'm just thinking about how many people could have been a Tarantino, you know what I mean, who just never had that chance. People who have an amazing cinematic mind and who understand film in a really unique way.
He could have been that guy on IMDb that's like trolling on every four.
And again, I think that his popularity and I think that his consistency, I think that rubs probably some people the wrong way who are always looking to knock somebody. People are always looking to knock somebody down from the top. When you're at the top for so long, a target. People are always gunning for you. They want to point out your shortcomings, even if it's a stretch to, you know, to say what you're going to say about an artist. And he's singular. I mean, he's a guy that doesn't give a shit. He makes his movies for himself. They're fucking violent. They're in your face. They're profane. And they're happy to be that. You know, and I wouldn't want him to change that for anything because it's just like, you know, I think, you know, both of us, you know, everybody on this podcast has said you can't imagine the cinematic landscape without the voice of Tarantino.
Absolutely. I mean, he really was like the voice of a new generation of filmmakers that was almost ready to, you know, turn Hollywood on its head and be like, no, here, I got something else that can really, you know, put you in for a deuce and, you know, let's see where it goes. And that's the thing. It's like maybe we'll never get another Jackie Brown, but the beauty of Jackie Brown is that there's only one like it, and no one can duplicate the magic of that movie. And I think Tarantino captured that magic at such a perfect setting with just the right kind of actors. It's like I can't imagine anyone like Robert Forster turning in a performance like Max Cherry. I mean, I love that character so much.
Yeah, I agree, man. I can't even wait to see what he does next. I mean, he's talked about so many projects over the years from, you know, the Vega Brothers film, which would be cool, but I know he's never going to make that. He wanted to make a James Bond movie. He wants to, at one point, wanted to do a Kill Bill 3.
Yeah.
He wants to do, like, another Django movie or something like that, but I don't know what he's going to do, and I honestly... You know, I was worried that Hateful Eight wasn't going to get made with that whole script leak where he threw that shit fit. And I was like, dude, you need to... Because I never read the script. I didn't want to read it.
Exactly.
I just want to go in not knowing anything. And that's why I love the teaser for Hateful Eight where it looks like Clue, but a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, with all these hard characters and this fantastical cast. I mean... I'm so glad that Bruce Dern's in it. I love Bruce Dern. I loved his cameo in Django Unchained.
Yeah.
it wasn't expected. It was so great when he popped up. I love that he reteamed with Kurt Russell after Kevin Costner was supposed to be in Django Unchained, and then he dropped out, and Kurt Russell was supposed to play the part, and then he dropped out, and then that role just kind of got cut from the film. But fantastical, man. This has been a great podcast on Jackie Brown and the encompassment of Tarantino. I can't believe that we really haven't talked about Tarantino at all yet. So I'm glad that you came on the show and we had a Tarantino Jackie Brown podcast.
Absolutely. I love Jackie Brown, and that's one of the more beautiful things about Tarantino. He's unpredictable. We can never tell what movies are going to do, and that makes it all that much better when we see it. We just don't know what to expect.
Yeah, certainly, man. Certainly.
Yeah, dude, thank you very much for coming on and chatting with us about one of our, obviously, a movie that means a lot to all three of us and something we've clearly watched more than maybe most. And it'll be exciting to certainly see where Tarantino takes us later this year and in the future for sure.
Oh, man, thanks so much for inviting me on this podcast. I love listening to you guys. Your interviews are phenomenal, and your commentary on The Great just gave me oodles of joy because I love that movie just as much as anyone. Such an underrated classic. You guys are like the dynamic duo of podcasting movies. So
thank you very much, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We're having a blast doing it and glad you're enjoying listening, and definitely means a lot. So thank you.
Thank you.